available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome from me, Nigel Hewin, to this week's edition of Outlook, being recorded on Wednesday the 12th of June 2024. And in this action-packed programme this week, we are going to carry on going round the Warwickshire villages, this time Bearley. We're finding out why chocolate suddenly got very expensive. And to lighten up your life, laughter is the best medicine, says Stella. Now, nursery rhymes, you all remember, have an origin, of course, and of course some of them aren't entirely PC now, but you're going to find more about their origin and heritage from Elaine. Now, with the election only a few weeks off, Susie Dent's come up with a piece called Flummery and Poppycock, and I suspect it's some references to all the hot air that's being blown around at the moment. And finally, Dave is going to talk to a puppy dog walker and her dog, a labradoodle called David as well. But before all that, we've got news from the centre, sport and your postbag, but we're going to start, as always, with the news with your leaders, Elaine and Peter.
Outlook News.
Health bosses say patients will receive better and safer care with the launch of a new digitised record system. University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire National Health Service Trust will unveil its new electronic patient record, EPR, system on Saturday, June the 15th. It will replace all paper-based notes and see all records and information is kept in one place, with all relevant medical staff having access. The system, introduced with Oracle Health, will mean patients no longer have to repeat the same information to different clinicians. Professor Andy Hardy, the Trust's chief executive, said, "We have been working extremely hard to develop and refine our new system, and we're delighted to enter the final stages before we launch it. EPR will make us much more efficient by providing a single trust-wide hospital record for every one of our patients. It will streamline the hundreds of different systems into one, so that all healthcare professionals working in the trust can quickly access up-to-date, reliable and consistent information. It will save our staff time by freeing them up from administrative tasks and duplicating information on paper to focus on what matters most. It will also improve our ability to share information with other care providers and enable us to start the most appropriate treatment for our patients sooner." It is said EPR will also help to improve patient safety through automated alerts and checks built into the system. Patient discharge processes will benefit as departments such as inpatient wards and pharmacy will be linked so that medicines will be available when patients are ready to return home. More details on the launch of EPR will be revealed as they become available. University Hospital Coventry and Warwickshire Trust includes University Hospital Coventry, the Hospital of St Cross in Rugby, working with Warwick University Medical School and Coventry University.
A huge new regenerative project is being planned for Coventry, dubbed City Centre North. It will cover an area by the city's transport museum. New homes, public spaces and transport links are part of early plans for the site. The project is being promoted by Coventry Council as an opportunity for a strategic investor to work in partnership with them. Their work would deliver significant housing growth in the centre, the council's website states. While the project is at a concept stage at the moment, some details of the council's aims are set out in a description on its website. The scheme would be a mixed one, meaning it would involve both residential and other spaces. It would include access hubs, expanding the Coventry VLR links and making it easier to use public transport to get to and from the city. The council also aims to encourage new inner-city communities, it adds. The way some people choose to live is changing, so we want to support this by providing environments including new co-living hubs, subscription living, creative studios and live-work spaces, as well as new townhouses and apartments. Plans for the scheme are referred to in council papers for a meeting later this month. The council learnt that it's been looking at how land on the northern edge of the city could accommodate physical regeneration and development and the delivery of new homes whilst also making better use of cultural and heritage assets, green space and public realm. This early stage was completed in March 2024 and informs the wider city centre vision, and we're now looking at how to begin delivery of key sites. Coventry Regeneration Chief Councillor Jim O'Boyle said he'd been talking to various people about the project for a long time. Asked when the council may bring sites forward, he stressed that the scheme is in its early days and work is still being done on City Centre South. He said, "There are no immediate plans to bring this particular site forward. There's still a lot to be done, but it's just laying out the potential for City Centre North."
Huge digital screens will be placed above two busy Coventry roads. The signs will go on a bridge over the A444 and both sides of the tunnel at Junction 6 of the Ring Road. Coventry City Council gained permission for the plans last week. A council spokesperson said the move will bring in extra income to help fund services, but emphasised that these screens are an important way of keeping residents informed and updated on events and issues in the city. "We are proud to be the second best digitally connected city in the UK, and we are investing in continuing this work as we welcome exciting new developments such as City Centre South, 2 Friargate and the Cultural Gateway." In a report on the plans, a council officer said the 12 by 3 metres screens are large, but would look well proportioned where they are placed. The report also referred to a road safety audit. This was a review of council plans for more screens across the city and described problems needing action to improve safety and reduce collisions, according to planning documents. The report added that moving images and directional symbols will not be allowed, and the council will have to show the structures can take the screens. They concluded the signs are acceptable in terms of public safety. The screen will also be off from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. A lighting assessment will also be carried out to see how intense the screen's brightness will be. These controls are all conditions of planning permission for the screens, and the council officer assessing the scheme said highways officers had accepted the audit subject to the conditions.
Coventry City Council has issued thousands of bus lane fines to drivers in the past year. The council issued 42,813 bus lane fines in the year to April 2024, an increase of 16,000 on the previous year. More than half of these related to just one bus gate. A bus gate is a short section of a road that can only be used by buses, as opposed to just one lane in a road. The bus gate on Hale Street, at the junction with the Burges, accounted for more than 27,000 of the fines, and this bus gate has been in force only since July 2023. The council issued fewer than 3,000 tickets for each of the other four bus lanes. Stony Road saw the fewest drivers fined, with just 963 penalty notices sent out. In contrast, just over 9,000 fines were sent out in 12 months for drivers using the bus lane at the Whittle Arch. The data showed that the council ranked highly for the number of fines when compared to similar authorities. Coventry, in fact, issued the fourth highest number of fines out of 22 metropolitan districts, with only Manchester, Sheffield and Birmingham sending out more. The tickets would be worth £1.2 million in revenue if every driver paid £30, the company said. A spokesperson for Coventry City Council said that access to bus lanes was restricted in order to reduce bus journey times and traffic, as well as to improve air quality. Drivers are caught out by ANPR cameras, which record cars using the lanes. Anyone breaking the rules is sent a £70 fine, which is reduced to £35 if paid within 21 days, but which rises to £105 if unpaid after 28 days. A spokesperson for the council said, access to bus lanes is restricted to buses, taxis and other authorised vehicles. Many local authorities enforce bus lanes and Coventry City Council introduced enforcement cameras in 2011. A new bus gate was introduced in Coventry City Centre in July 2023 and it's this that has resulted in the amount of fines increasing so much. Mind you, any driver who receives a fine for driving in a bus lane in Coventry can choose to appeal to an independent adjudication service.
Residents have been warned that they may have to fork out extra cash for the new paid-for waste garden collection service in Coventry. Thousands have already paid the yearly fee of £40. Councillors announced earlier this year that they would be introducing a fee for brown-lidded waste collections. Collections for the new citywide service began on Monday, June the 3rd. Bins will only be collected if they have a sticker on them and are placed outside by 7 a.m, the council said. Residents are being encouraged to purchase the one-year permits, which cover the period from June the 1st to May the 31st. A yearly permit fee of £40 promises fortnightly collections, and residents must display the sticker on the correct side of their bins to show that they have paid up. They are fortnightly collections with a pause for Christmas. However, the £40 fee for the new waste collection service could rise in 2025, next year. Coventry City Council has said the current brown-lidded bin service charge is subject to possible annual increases in line with fees and charges, meaning that the price of the yearly permit may rise. The council said any increases will be communicated ahead of time, but Coventrians are less than impressed. One warned, "Masses more fly tipping, here we come." But at least it's biodegradable. Another added, most unfair to talk about an increase on the very first week that it was introduced. A flat rate levy without any consideration for those who struggle with daily cost of living. It's wholly inappropriate of the council to declare imminent annual price increases before the start of this bin service. However, some argued that Coventry isn't the first to charge for garden waste. Why do people think everything will be free from cradle to grave? Councils have been charging for years. They are not charity.
8 13th century catapult shots have been discovered perfectly preserved outside the walls of Kenilworth Castle. English Heritage said that the shots would have been fired during the siege of the castle in 1266, one of the longest sieges in English history, when the country was in the grip of civil war. The shots found range from between 1 kilogram and 105 kilograms in weight, and some were found just below the surface of the ground. The discovery was made during a project to improve accessibility around Kenilworth Castle. Will Wyeth, English Heritage's properties historian, said, "We were able immediately to link these findings to the 1266 siege because of similar finds recovered in the 1960s. But it's not every day we get lucky enough to stumble across historical remains like this." For a total of 172 days, from the 25th of June to the 13th of December 1266, Kenilworth Castle was under constant attack in one of the most significant military contests of the reign of Henry III. The king's conflict with his nobles had escalated into civil war some years earlier. Mr. Wyeth said, "Imagine the surprise of the team when we unearthed these impressive stone projectiles nearly 800 years old. These would have caused some serious damage when fired from war machines. In fact, records show that one of Henry III's wooden siege towers, which contained around 200 crossbowmen, was destroyed by just one well-timed missile. King Henry III used a large arsenal of weaponry in his attacks on Kenilworth Castle, including 60,000 crossbow bolts and 9 siege engines, including these catapults, to attempt to breach the 14-foot thick walls. After almost 6 months, the resistant efforts of the rebels succumbed to starvation and disease, and they surrendered Kenilworth Castle to the king, who then gave it to his son, Edmund, Earl of Lancaster."
A memorial bench has been unveiled in France to honour 154 men killed or injured during a battle on the day after D-Day. The engraved bench in Liberty Wood, Normandy, has been set up to honour soldiers from the Royal Warwickshire Regiment who took part in the campaign on the 7th of June 1944. The day after D-Day, the battalion was called into action to clear the remaining suburbs of Bionneville before attacking south, capturing Liberty Wood and the accompanying village, which sat on a hill overlooking the city of Cairn. Jason Woods from the Royal Warwickshire Reenactment Group described the event as a tremendous battle, which the soldiers had been ill-prepared for. Various catastrophes along the way, mainly with communication, meant that the guys had no idea what was waiting for them in this wooded area. It was a horrific battle with horrific losses. Mr. Woods, whose relative George Bruton took part in the battle, said he felt the Royal Warwickshire Regiment who were involved should be remembered. "We wanted to do it for the whole of the Warwickshire Regiment in Normandy," Mr. Woods said, "and it looks brilliant in the memorial. It adds to where people can sit and reflect."
The curator of the Coventry Music Museum has been nominated as a volunteer hero in an upcoming celebration of the West Midlands. Local music historian Pete Chambers has been nominated to be one of the 50 volunteer heroes to represent his local area. This is part of the Big Thank You celebration being held at the Great Hall at the University of Birmingham on June the 23rd. The event will be hosted by His Majesty the King's representative in the West Midlands, Lord Lieutenant Sir John Crabtree. Representatives have been selected for their outstanding contributions as volunteers. Pete Chambers said of the honour, "Of course, it's wonderful to be part of these things, but someone said, if you get a job you love, you will never work again, and that's me. So being rewarded for something I love is crazy but wonderful at the same time, and I want to thank my own team of volunteers who are amazing and who keep the Coventry Music Museum running. From March to April 2024, local volunteers of all backgrounds and ages were nominated for helping their communities in the 7 local authorities in the West Midlands, Birmingham, Coventry, Dudley, Sandwell, Solihull, Walsall and Wolverhampton. This is all part of the legacy of the Birmingham Commonwealth Games. From these nominations, a judging panel selected 350 volunteers from each of the 7 local authorities who will be invited to join the Big Thank You Bash. These 350 volunteers will then be narrowed down to just 50, and from that final shortlist, one volunteer will be chosen for their outstanding contribution. As a special thank you, the chosen volunteer will have a tram on the West Midlands Metro named in their honour as a lasting tribute to their commitment to volunteering and their positive impact on the local community. Let's hope it's Pete Chambers who has the tram named after him.
A Coventry man has broken a Guinness World Record after running 1,000 marathons in the fastest average time. Steve Edwards from Wyking completed the feat on May the 6th at the Milton Keynes Marathon, being followed across the finish line by his son Jason and grandson Farron. The 61-year-old's average time at the end of it all was 3 hours, 21 minutes and 47 seconds. Steve started his marathon journey when he entered the inaugural Coventry Marathon in 1981 at the age of 18. He said that after the first one, he vowed never again, but then went on to enter another four marathons in Coventry until 1985. By 2024, he completed a marathon on average every 13 days for the past 36 years. Throughout his marathon training, Steve has been racking up the accolades. In 1990, at 28 years old, he became the youngest person to run 100 marathons. 2 years later, he ran the largest number of marathons in a 12-month period, crossing the line 87 times. However, it wasn't until 2010 that his passion for running 26 miles was taken up a gear. Throughout the 2010s, he ran over 400 marathons, and by the time he hit his 800th, the goal of 1,000 was firmly in his sights. By his 996th, he had sustained a painful hip injury, which meant his last four races had him battling through the pain. However, when he crossed the line in Milton Keynes this year, he said he couldn't believe it was over. They're all tough events, but when you're carrying an injury, that sort of distance will always find your weaknesses. It was such a mix of emotions. Relief was the first one, but I broke down within half a minute just from the joy and relief of it all. The day after just flew. It was gone as quick as it came. So many mixed emotions, and it's been such a long time coming. He said the effort had been a trying one, with him running a marathon almost every weekend, but his wife Teresa and family had been at his side all the way through. We sacrificed a lot of things other families might otherwise do at the weekend, like Sunday dinners or going out in the afternoon. We'd more often than not be travelling to a race, running a race and travelling home again. Despite having 1,000 marathons under his belt, Steve is hoping for a few more. I'd like to think there'll be 1,001, or maybe 1,002. I won't be chasing any numbers or records. I'd like to enjoy my running a bit more leisurely, rather than piling in training sessions week in and week out, like I've been doing the past four decades.
A key feature at one of Coventry's Roman sites is set to reopen to the public for the first time in a decade. Visitors will be able to access the 30-foot viewing platform on Lunt Roman Fort's Gatehouse in Baginton during the Lunt Roman Festival on the 3rd and 4th of August. This platform has been off-limits for almost 10 years while work has been carried out to renovate the ramparts, which were initially reconstructed in 1974. Lisa Ford, Head of Learning and Engagement at CV Life, which operates Lunt Fort, said she was delighted to have the gatehouse back to its full potential. She said, "The gatehouse is such a symbolic part of the Lunt Roman Fort, as it was the original column posts of this structure that led to the whole site initially being discovered in Baginton." Almost 2,000 people are expected to attend the two-day festival, which will include horse-mounted battle reenactments for the first time. Tickets for the festival are available on the Lunt Roman Fort website. Darren Tosh, a director at Shakespeare's England, said, "The Lunt Roman Fort is one of our region's hidden gems, so it's fantastic to see them expanding their offering in preparation for one of their biggest weekends of the year. Alongside our medieval castles in Warwick and Kenilworth, and being home to one of the world's greatest playwrights, the Lunt Roman Fort underlines our region's broad and proud history that is so vital to the prosperity of the area."
Coventry's modernist architecture, much of which is at risk, is being celebrated in a new exhibition. Paul Catherall's lino-cut prints showing landmarks such as the Bullyard and railway station form part of the show at Coventry Cathedral. Each building featured, apart from the cathedral, is set to be redeveloped, closed, uncertain or under threat, he said. The city has undergone a lot of redevelopment in recent years. About 1,500 homes are set to be built as part of a £450 million scheme affecting the City Arcade, Market Way, Shelton Square and Hertford Street. Some public art, such as the listed Three Tons mural, will be moved and new pieces created, said the developer's Shearer Property Region. We understand the importance of preserving public art and heritage features for the enjoyment of future generations, it added. In November 1940, German bombers destroyed much of Coventry's city centre. It was rebuilt in what was then thought of as a bold, modern style. Redevelopment of those buildings has meant some have been lost or left empty. I'm not a slave to thinking everything has to be kept, Mr. Catherall said, but it's definitely turned into a tribute to what could be completely lost. His print showed the buildings in their best light, he added, to give them a bit of their original glamour. One print shows the city's Grade 2 listed sports and leisure centre building, which closed 4 years ago and remains empty. It was a real groundbreaking piece of architecture. It got glowing reviews when it was built, and for it to be left empty is just really sad, said the printmaker. Coventry City Council said it was still working to secure an occupier for the site and was spending about £400,000 a year to maintain and secure it. William Mitchell's Three Tons mural is listed and will be moved as part of the city centre redevelopment. For his prints to be shown in the cathedral was amazing, said Mr. Catherall, who grew up in the city. I honestly did not walk around age 13 or 14 admiring the brutalist architecture, but your surroundings seep into you, he said. Centrum Coventry exhibition is on display at Coventry Cathedral until July the 7th.
Outlook News.
My thanks there to Elaine and Peter for the news. Now, a few little announcements. First, of course, the usual one, sunrise and sunset. Sunrise 4:45, sunset 9:28. Also, I was going to make a few comments about the news, actually. One shouldn't be political in this organisation, but really, I was really quite surprised with Elaine's sceptical voice about hospital records. I hope she's wrong, but I do rather share her scepticism. The other one was screens around the ring road to advise people what's going on. It was a total distraction, I thought, for drivers. However, never mind. And also, I'm very surprised that bus lanes improve air quality. But, you know, any excuse will do, I suppose. And finally, a reminder about bands in the park. This Sunday, Stoke Park. I'm not sure what the band is. Do we know what the band is, little name?
No, not yet.
It hasn't yet been known. And then, of course, the 23rd is at Alderley Park, the Phoenix Rock and Roll Band. Now, I am pleased to say I'm joined with two people from the centre here. One, of course, is Joe. He was away, is he?
Yes, he was away just for the afternoon.
And Chris. So hello. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nigel. So, hello, everybody. It's Joe here again, and Chris has joined me for, I think, your first time on the radio here, Chris.
Is it in the big studio? Yes, I feel very good.
So, Chris, as you know, runs our services, basically, all of the activity groups that we have running here. So I've asked him to come in and just fill you in a little bit on some recent developments. But before that, just a few notices from me. So I know you're hearing quite a lot from us about fundraising events and various things like that. So the Summer Garden Party, I'm still praying for good weather. It's not looking good already, is it? My heating came on this morning again. So we're not exactly in sunny weather yet, but let's hope by the 13th of July we are. And the plan is to have lots of stalls outside, have our afternoon teas out in the lawn, and got the Coventry Yukaholics ukulele band coming to entertain us, and various other things going on. We're looking, of course, for volunteers, and also anyone who'd like to bake some cakes that we can sell. tin loaf cakes go very well, very popular. So if you're good at baking, you want to do something to contribute to that, we'd be very grateful. The other thing to just say to you is about the theatre trip that's coming up on Tuesday the 25th of June. That is now full. We've got our full cohort for that evening. If you're desperate to come and you haven't got your name down, I guess we could put you on a waiting list, but I think at this point in time it's unlikely that there'll be more tickets available. And the only other thing I would like to just mention is something perhaps new to some people. I had not heard of these people myself until fairly recently. There's an organisation called Health Watch Coventry. There's a Health Watch England, and then in each local authority area of the country there is a Health Watch organisation. They are funded through public money, and their job is to make sure that people in the local area that they cover, especially disadvantaged communities, are able to access health and care services. So they do a lot of background research work to make sure that services are being made accessible to people, and where they think there are problems, they do research work to try and find out more about what problems there are, and they feed back into various health and care organisations, including the local hospitals, and they do quite a lot of good background work. They have a helpline too, so if you are somebody that has been having particular problems accessing health or care services, you could use their helpline number, and that number is, for Health Watch Coventry, it's 0300 012 0315. So they welcome hearing from people, and they often try and make sure that you are, if you are having particular problems, that you're given advice and help to make sure you get what you need. So I just wanted to mention them as well. If anyone's got any opinions about all of that, feel free to talk to us about it. So that's all from me. So Chris, I think, is now going to talk to you about three different things that are happening at the centre.
That's right. Thank you, Jo. As Jo mentioned, I'm responsible for the services that centre deliver. And one of the services we deliver is a walking group. And the leader of that walking group, Peter, is sat opposite me right now. And the walking group, as I'm sure Peter would agree, is so big and so well attended that we're starting a second one. So if anybody would like to join that and isn't already part of the Wednesday group, that will be starting on Tuesdays, basically effective immediately. And it runs from 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. So the usual buses and all that apply. So ring up if you'd like to come and join us.
Can you just mention, Chris, that the Wednesday one is still running?
Oh, absolutely.
But it's still running 10 till 12. We're not changing the timing of the Wednesday one in case anyone...
That's right.
Just make sure people don't get confused.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anybody does want... If anybody's currently doing the Wednesday and thinks that actually Tuesday would fit in better, you know, you are welcome to switch over. You're not stuck with a particular one. Now, as some of you may have heard, because David interviewed me a couple of weeks ago, we have a table here for a sport called Showdown, which is like air hockey, but for people wearing blindfolds. Now, eventually we're going to be setting up a team to join a big league and all this kind of posh stuff. But before that, we're going to start a sort of basic Showdown social club. We don't have a day or time for it yet, but if anybody's interested in that, the idea will be you'll come in and for a couple of hours you'll just play very friendly games against each other. There'll be a little bit of training, but it'll be more about having a laugh and, you know, having a chat to each other and playing a bit of Showdown. So that is that. And finally, this is a bit of an exercise trio I've got going here. We have a Tai Chi group that runs on Thursdays. Now the time of that escapes me. Do you happen to know, Jo?
Well, I'm not in on Thursdays, so I'm trying to be a bit here. Is it 1 o'clock till two?
I think it's something like that. Yeah. Anyway, it's in the afternoon. It's a good post lunch activity, and we have quite a lot of space in that. So if anybody would like to join, it's run by a really nice man called Tony, and Tai Chi is very kind of slow, relaxing but not easy exercises. A bit of breathing. It's very good for you. So if anybody would like to join in with that, please also ring up the centre, keep yourself booked in. And we'd love to see you Tai Chi with us. That's all from me. Thank you very much.
Good. That's it from you, from Chris and from Joe. And so thank you very much. See you next time.
Thank you.
Sarah, no doubt, is still impatiently counting down the days until the Olympics, even though she has poorly hands still. But in the meantime, here's her current sports report for the last week.
Well, hello there, lovely, wonderful listeners. Right. Well, this weekend was a real feast for those of us who love our sport. But unfortunately, there wasn't really any local sport, so I'm just going to pick out a few of the highlights before I major later on about the European football, which starts on Friday. Okay? And apparently we're going into the summer of sport. Well, I'd just be happy for a bit of summer right now. Now, it's been, well, it still is, the European Athletics. Thus far, we've only had one gold medalist, Indina Asher-Smith, who ran and won the 100 metres, which is great to see her back on the scene. Although we got a lot in the finals tonight. But what really strikes me is how we've got great strength in some events, but no one, or next to no one, in the other events. I mean, the men's 1500 metres, I think at the Olympics, we could field the whole of the final eight if we were allowed to. We're limited, of course, to three, although we may be entitled to a fourth, as Josh Kerr is the world record holder, world champion rather, but I don't know that for sure. So we've got great strength actually as well in the female sprints with Darrenita and Dina. But I have to say, of course, in the European athletics, you haven't got the Caribbean athletes and the American athletes. So perhaps the strength won't be that great. But anyway, they're doing all right, and I'll bring you the total medal haul next week. Now, on Saturday and Sunday, it was the finals at the French Open. Well, you'll remember that I said that all of our singles players went out in the first round, but we got hopes of our doubles players. Well, I mean to bother, because none of them got as far as the semis. Apart from the perennial pair of Alfie Hewitt and Gordon Reid, who won the wheelchair men's doubles. So I'm afraid it's not looking very good for the Olympics, is that tennis, because it's also played at Roland Garros. Although hopefully for the Paralympics, we'll get a couple of gold medals there. Now, I'll just mention the winners. The winner of the ladies was Iga Świątek of Poland. She is the world number one, and it was her fourth win in France. And she actually won in just over an hour. I think the score was 6-2, 6-1. But the Italian, who was her opponent, didn't really expect to be there. And did pretty well. Unfortunately, she also lost in the doubles, in the women's doubles, the following day in the finals. Anyway, the winner of the men's was Carlos Alcaraz of Spain. Now, this was a different matter because it went to five sets against Alexander Zverev. But, I mean, I think listening to it, Alcaraz was a worthy winner. But he was obviously helped by the fact that Novak Djokovic had to withdraw injured after the quarterfinals. Novak is well known for sliding sideways rather than sort of cantering sideways. But I'm afraid on the clay court that don't work. And he did his lower leg muscles, and he's actually had surgery, so I don't know whether he'll be at Wimbledon. But his big aim is to win the gold for Serbia at the Olympics, and I wouldn't begrudge him that. Now, before I go on to the ramble, I'm just going to say something about the rugby union, because I know Sue Parker listens to this programme. Don't you, Sue? Wake up! And I want to give a big shout-out to Bath. Bath were the runners-up in the Premiership final, where they lost to Northampton. But my gosh, haven't Bath come a long way from the days when our beloved Malcolm used to, shall we say, take the mickey out of you. So well done, Bath, and well done, Northampton. Well, I'm pleased to say that last week I was actually the reverse of the commentator's curse, whatever the reverse of a curse is. Anyway, after England lost in their dismal 2-1 defeat by France at home, I said that by the time you heard this tape last week, they would no doubt have lost again, this time away at St Etienne. Well, they didn't. No, they turned the tables and they beat France 2-1. So this is getting a bit good for our European Championship hopes, because it puts us equal with Sweden and only 2 points behind France. So it's all getting rather close. Anyway, come on, Serena's gals, you can do it. Now, already on their way to the European Championships, well, probably they'll be there by the time you hear this, but probably not on the way yet at the time I'm recording this, are our men's team, who are playing in the 2024 European Championships. Mind you, after their dismal 1-0 loss to Iceland last week at Wembley, I don't think we should really bother. But hey-ho, let's look positive. So, I thought I'd tell you a few facts about this year's Europeans. There are 26 teams in the Euros. 26, I know, but they're divided into 6 groups, mostly 4s, but with a couple of 5s. Whew, England stand a better chance. They're in one with 4, as are Scotland. But they're in a much tougher group, with teams including Germany, Switzerland, they can be tricky people, and Hungary, they have got an outstanding record. Anyway, I think Scotland are just hoping to make it out of the group stage, whereas England, of course, have great hopes. And we know what usually happens to their great hopes. Although you're probably rather bored of hearing some of these. Now, as I'm sure you know, this year they are to be held in Germany. And it's actually the first time that Germany has staged them. Well, it's not actually, but the last time they held them, they were West Germany. So this is the first time that the United Germany has staged them, because that was back in the 70s, 72 I believe. Now they kick off, literally, with Germany, the hosts, playing Scotland on Friday the 14th of June. So that will probably, hopefully, be the day that you're receiving or listening to this. Otherwise you might have missed it. But never mind. Anyway, the kick-off for that match is at 8 p.m. and it's covered on BBC Radio 5 Live and also on TV on ITV1. But then England play Serbia on Sunday, equally at 8 o'clock. But that is on BBC One. England should have a reasonable chance of getting out of their group stage. Because in their group alongside them are Slovenia, Denmark and Serbia. Mind you, with England, you just never can tell. Anyway, I'll keep you posted. Now, this tournament is literally or just in Germany, which is actually quite rare now because it seems to be the done thing for a number of countries to share the hosting of an event. But it is really all over Germany. So the venues are the Olympische Stadion in Berlin. I'm presuming that must be the original Olympic Stadium from the Hitler Olympics. Because the last Olympics in Germany were actually in Munich. Cologne, Dortmund, Düsseldorf, Frankfurt, Gelsenkirchen, Hamburg, Leipzig, Munich and Stuttgart. I think the opening match on the 14th of June is in Munich, but the final is in the Olympische Stadion. Oh, I like saying that. Olympische Stadion in Berlin. And that is on the 14th of July. So, if you don't like football, that's your day to ring. Way when it's all over. But if you do like football, that is the day to really look forward to. For other information, it's still the qualifying rounds until June the 26th. And then the quarters, the semis and the final, etc. all take place from the 29th of June, leading up until the 14th of July. And finally, going back to the French Open now, a little snippet I just heard. One of the players slipped on the court and when he got a lot of red dust sort of all over him. And the commentator said, well, that's the problem with clay. Literally, the court is made of compressed house bricks, broken up, obviously, and then tightly compressed. Well, I wouldn't like to fall on that. Bring on Wimbledon. And that, this week, has been your sport. Bye!
Well, I suppose between grass and crushed bricks, I certainly prefer grass, but actually, of course, the best option is stay standing. So, what's in the postbag? Let's find out from Dave.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello and welcome to your postbag. First of all, Janet of the Monday Club kindly told me that she enjoyed my report on the maypole dancing at the Charterhouse. Thank you, Janet. The next time the Charterhouse is open is Saturday the 22nd and Sunday the 23rd of June, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. I do urge you to visit this wonderful Coventry treasure. There are lifts to every floor with guides to describe the wall paintings to you, and there's a pop-up cafe joined onto the Charterhouse. When the Charterhouse was open to the public, run by volunteers, I interviewed the TV chef Glyn Purnell, who then owned the cafe and bistro there. Graham Whale Thortide interviewed Reg Dixon, who used to appear at the Coventry Theatre and frequent the cottage at Forlongley that had recently caught fire due to a faulty tumble dryer. I didn't interview him myself, but somebody else on Outlook may have done. Reg used to own a farm in Forlongley, which would explain him visiting the cottage. He came on stage once with a very painful boil in his mouth, saying, I'm poorly, I'm proper poorly. He got a laugh, so it became his catchphrase. He had a hit with the song Confidentiality, and it adopted the song I'm Shy, Mary Ellen, I'm Shy, and made it his own. This week, Graham talks about the comedy writer Nick Croft.
I did enjoy the item on Nick Croft talking about his father, David Croft. And yes, a very good way of describing Dad's Army. It is a comforting thing to listen to. And I wouldn't mind going to Wilmington on sea for a holiday. And I've got just about every programme of the radio version of Dad's Army on different formats of cassettes, CD, etc. And I also listen to them on the radio on 4Extra. And also when they're on television. And the beauty of these old programmes, the writing's very good. If you listen to these classic comedies like Dad's Army, Take It From Here, Step to and Son Hancock's Half Hour, and a whole raft of them, there's never more than three writers, usually two, occasionally there's three. If you listen to the credits of modern day comedy, there's a long list of writers, absolutely tremendous list of writers, and the programmes just aren't funny. So there you go.
Thank you, Graham. Well, a comic folk singer was entertaining the Tump Folk Club at the Humber recently, the eldest son Paul belongs to. He had written jokes for Phil Cool and Jasper Carrot. And on Thursday the 6th of June at the Tump Folk Club, Paul, with the help of his musical partner in their duo Yonderland, Jane, put on a concert in memory of Sheila in aid of Coventry Resource Centre for the Blind. It was great to see new member of the Monday Club, Elizabeth, there, and her daughter, Elise. Also, Julie Element, who plays with Visibly Sound. She sang a song she'd written about Visibly Sound that she'd adapted to sing about one of the two women who saved the resource centre, Rosie.
Oh, Rosie, you welcomed us all through the fold, the lonely, the frail, the young and the old. The deaf, the blind, on their sight is half deaf or half dat. All were invited for tea and a laugh. Oh, Rosie, your legacy lives on and on, in the warmth of the smile and the sound of the song. The warmth of the centre will echo your laugh as the blind leads the blind up the garden path. Rosie kept us going throughout all the years, through hiccups and lockdowns, volatile but volatile volunteers. Barking mad guide dogs and fundraising fears, we raise a glass to you, Rosie, so hip hooray cheers.
And I'm pleased to say the concert raised £238 for the Resource Centre. Meanwhile, Julia has been on holiday. This is her latest report. Story of a Malteser. I took my two sisters for a four-day break in Malta. The first day we didn't arrive until 7:15, so we just got drunk and went to bed. But on the next day we went somewhere very important, but I don't remember where it was or what we did. It was hard to spell, though. It was a very good gin. That was our magical mystery tour on Wednesday. On Thursday, we went on a ferry to Gozo. I think I had a good time, but I can't remember much. There was a citadella, whatever that is. Then we went to a fishing village, but we didn't catch any fish. Then we went to a temple, but I didn't say my prayers. Friday saw us in the Malta capital, Valletta. It took us more than 3 hours, and we went to a garden. Anyway, we had lots of lovely food, ice creams and fish and chips. Later, I went to a massage parlour. I don't want to write about it because it's confidential. It was very relaxing and I nearly went to sleep. We did lots of shopping and the shopping centre was very big, just like the Bullring in Birmingham. It even had a Primark, but I didn't buy anything for my friend John because he's a pain in the rear. It's good to be back. Lots of love, Julia. Thank you, Julia. The Citadella, or Citadel, is a fortress in Malta on the island of Gozo. The area has been occupied by the Citadella. It's believed to have been the Acropolis of the Punic Roman city of Gorlos or Gloconis, Civitas. So now you know. Now, I'm going with the Macula Society for a day trip to the National Arboretum soon at the kind invitation of Judith Misserton, who has also kindly written this article for me. Judith says, it's a lovely little story about a plucky penguin. Thought you may be able to use it if we have a gap in postbag. Thank you very much. Plucky penguin becomes guide bird for his visually impaired friend. A 3-year-old penguin from Surrey has taken on the role of guide bird for a companion with a cataract, creating an extraordinary friendship. Penguin, a hand-reared African penguin from Bird World, the largest bird park in the UK, swiftly bonded with Squid, a fellow 3-year-old African penguin who had developed cataracts, a debilitating condition that clouds the lens of the eye and impairs vision. From their early days as adolescent chicks, the close-knit duo amazed Bird World's keepers with their remarkable friendship. Squid, often disorientated during busy feeding times, relies on penguin's unwavering calmness. By standing close to the keepers, penguin inadvertently became Squid's beacon, guiding her around the enclosure and acting as her eyes. Squid, who has congenital cataracts, used to be quite anxious about approaching the fish bucket at feeding time because the excitement of other penguins created a more unpredictable environment, and she would shy away from this for fear of getting caught in the crossfire of beaks. That is how a penguin has been such an enormous help to her. Her stability was something she could rely on, the base from which she has steadily expanded her world. You can find Penguin and Squid at Bird World. Thank you so much, Judith, for sharing your creative writing with your fellow listeners in Postbag. It was nice to see you in the tea room before the creative writing group that John was urging you to join. He wants to be your scribe if you need one. So John says, "Giz a job." Edwina is understandably having a break from recording messages for Postbag following the sudden loss of her son, Darren, which I was terribly sad about. Darren, like his dad, was a brilliant table tennis player of international standard. He was a very kind man. Edwina told me that he was always ready to help a neighbour, whether it was walking or looking after a dog, putting back up a fence that had been blown down the storm, or helping neighbours to move home. He was the official carer to his mum, and through his mum he volunteered to drive the minibus for the resource centre. You will remember his little dog used to go with him everywhere, including on the minibus. I remember a lovely outing he organised to Wrighton Pools. And Darren joined the lockdown when people were allowed to meet in groups of a maximum of 6 outdoors, organised unofficial picnics in the Memorial Park with visually impaired people being socially distanced, and they were very enjoyable and safe. He was very warm and hospitable and did a lot to make people feel less isolated, including me, after Sheila had died. It is sad that he felt so lonely himself. My kind thoughts go to Edwina. And I'd like to finish with Graham's song that he wrote himself, and my two sons, Paul and Graham, sang with me at a charity concert recently at the Folk Club. We're gonna be there for you.
We're gonna be there for you. Step in some highs and step in some lows. You were there when I had no place to go. There were times when I was afraid. I won't forget the friends we made. Oh, yeah. We're gonna be there for you. We're gonna be there for you. Oh, we're gonna be there for you. We're gonna be there for you.
And that is our message to you, particularly if you're feeling lonely. Tell us your memories of Darren, and I will pass them on to Edwina. And anything else you want to talk about in Postbag, bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
So, those are your messages this week in Dave's Postbag. Now, from the borders of Warwickshire last week, Elaine goes right to the middle of the county and is at Bearley this time.
Bearley lies just off the A3400 between Henley in Arden and Stratford-upon-Avon, and is spread over a wooded hillside with many attractive old farmhouses and cottages and its own shop and post office. It was first mentioned in the Domesday Book Survey of 1086, and referred to as Byrley. It means a fortification in a clearing. At that time it consisted of 5 hides, a hide being an area of land large enough to support a family and the dependents. There is a local tale associated with Windmill Wood concerning the miller of Bearley. He is said to return to the woods with 6 black horses every midsummer moon to look for his gold, allegedly hidden under 2 millstones. It is while he is away watering his horses that the youth of the village can attempt to lift the stones and steal the gold. In 1100, land ownership was held by the monks of Bordersley, and a small church was built by them on the hill leading out of the village. Although rebuilt over the centuries, some Norman stonework is still visible, including the 15th century font still in use today. The first known school in the village was set up in the 1820s at No. 1 The Yard. This was followed in 1877 by the Board School, built in School Lane, and still standing today, in use as a private house. During the Second World War, various additional buildings were used as schoolrooms to accommodate the increasing number of children as the village grew. Finally, in 1952, a new infant and junior school was built in Grange Road, which was in use until 1988, when it was closed due to falling numbers. The village still holds the annual village fete in August, and on Palm Sunday a procession with palms and donkeys. The opening of a new village hall, an extension of the existing one, will enable villagers to put on entertainment and provide leisure facilities, as well as being a venue for existing village groups.
And next week she moves south to Bidford-on-Avon. I think we're all aware how costs for nearly everything have risen enormously over the last few months, but one item that has risen, in fact skyrocketed, is chocolate made from cocoa beans. But what's caused it? Maybe Sue's got the answer in this article written by James Ball.
Whether it's Cadbury or Galaxy, Lidl or Lindt, the making of every good chocolate bar starts with the humble cocoa bean, to which sugar, milk and whatever else is added to make a treat for millions of us to enjoy every week. Bad news may be on the horizon for chocolate lovers, though, as the price of cocoa beans has almost tripled in a year, blasting through its all-time ceiling and rising. In April 2023, 1 tonne of cocoa beans cost £2,100. That same amount today would cost £5,800, according to the Federal Reserve Economic Data (FRED) database. Given cocoa makes up anything from about 30% of a milk chocolate bar to 85% or more for dark chocolate, the sudden spike could mean shop prices could be set to rise, and there may even be shortages on the shelves or changes to recipes to compensate. The reasons for the price spike reveal the complicated story behind the bean. Cocoa, it turns out, is a notoriously difficult crop that is beset by difficulties. Even with a trained grower, a new cocoa crop planted this year won't produce any beans for 4 to 5 years, though it will then produce cocoa for up to 30 years. Quality and yield can drop markedly as the plant comes to the end of its life, however. The result is that farmers can't just switch in or out of cocoa in response to prices. If there's a shortage of cocoa this year, no one can suddenly produce more. The supply is essentially fixed. That problem is made even more difficult by where cocoa is grown. Almost two-thirds of the world's cocoa is grown in the neighbouring West African countries of Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire, both of which have been mired in political and economic instability, discouraging investment in cocoa. Further bad news for growers is a fungal disease that affects cocoa, known as black pod disease. It destroys the pods of affected trees and kills some entirely, leading to a loss of around a third of the crop most years. However, the fungus thrives in wet weather and spreads more easily in it, and West Africa had a particularly rainy winter. That combination of events would be more than enough to send prices spiking on their own, but prices were for a time driven even higher by financial speculation. Cocoa is a relatively small market versus larger crops such as wheat or soy, and so it's more volatile if hedge funds choose to speculate on it. These hedge funds trade futures, the right to have 1 ton of cocoa delivered to you on a given date, with no intention of ever actually taking inventory of any cocoa. In the 2000s, one trader, unsuccessfully, tried to corner the world's cocoa supply, earning himself the nickname Chockfinger in the financial press. This year, according to reporting by Bloomberg, a hedge fund run by former Merrill Lynch trader Paul Mulvaney managed a much more successful trade on the cocoa market, cashing in on the rapidly rising prices as the weather in West Africa failed to improve. Cocoa has rallied primarily because of disease and flooding in Africa, said one industry insider. This has provided some very strong trends that have benefited commodity trading advisers who follow trends across futures. The insider noted that speculation might continue to contribute to rising prices, given there's no obvious short-term way to boost cocoa supply, leaving prices for the next few years largely dependent on the weather. Unfortunately for British consumers, most of the surge in cocoa prices has yet to show up on the shelves. The big producers use contracts that fix the price they pay for months at a time, delaying the effect of big spikes in the markets. Those contracts only delay price rises, meaning that chocolate could be set to get much more expensive. The higher the percentage of cocoa in the bar, the more it is affected by cocoa prices, meaning dark chocolate fans have much more to worry about. Some Lindt and Green and Black's dark chocolate bars are already 32% more expensive than a year ago. Own brand chocolate also tends to rise more sharply because the price reflects the cost of ingredients rather than a brand, as does milk chocolate, is up 55%. Elsewhere, chocolates are shrinking to avoid price spikes. The consumer organisation Which found over Easter that Mars large chocolate egg had shrunk by 20% from 252 grams last year to 201 grams. The big chocolate companies have been trying for decades to make the supply of cocoa more stable and less reliant on Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire. In 2010, Cadbury invested in the Indian state of Kerala, trying to encourage coconut farmers to produce cocoa. The two trees can coexist, and making India the only country where cocoa beans are grown, harvested, turned into bars, and sold in the same nation. However, more than a decade on, India still produces considerably less than 1% of the world's cocoa. For now, there is nothing to be done except hope for better weather in West Africa and maybe stockpile an extra bar or two.
As a bit of a chocoholic, I still have it as one of my indulgences, and so it remains on my shopping list despite the cost. Stella's piece about Tuesday stirred some memories for me last week. I'd almost forgotten about Tuesday World, as well as Ruby Tuesday. This time Stella's talking about something entirely different, and something we all enjoy, laughter.
Laughter is the best medicine, we're told. And I did hear a story once about a man who, when given the news that he had a terminal illness, locked himself in a room with tapes of all his favourite comedians and laughed his way into health. I can't verify the truth of this, but I do remember a minor incident in my own life which happened many years ago and does seem to demonstrate the power of laughter. I was home from work with a terrible cold, and during the morning a package arrived for my mother, which we proceeded to try and undo. Said package was extremely large, and when we eventually managed to strip off the thick brown outer wrapping paper, a tea chest stood revealed. The top was securely battened down with wooden strips, and Mum and I prized these off with great difficulty. It all seemed to be taking ages, and we were deeply intrigued as to what could possibly be within. When at last we gained access, we came upon, da-da, mounds of packing straw. We delved, we probed, we brought out huge handfuls, but still we could find nothing. By this time we'd begun to giggle a little, but as more and more straw emerged from the depths onto the carpet, these small giggles grew and grew. Soon we were half deep in packaging, three quarters of the way down the tea chest, and, eureka, I put my hand on a priceless piece of treasure, a pencil slim chrome bar, about 6 inches in length. By now Mum and I were helpless, with that laughter that makes it hard to go on breathing. Further delving into the straw depths gave birth to a couple of other such bars, a chrome ring the size of a shoe polish tin, and last but not least, three china light shades, one inside the other, just large enough to cover three small light bulbs. Mum now remembered that she had ordered this light fitting from a Littlewoods catalogue. We speculated, between gasps and hoots of laughter, on what the packers used when someone ordered a set of matching vases, or, unimaginably, a whole dinner service. Recovering a little, we began to shift the mounds of straw and the great tea chest out into the garden, so that the living room might be restored to some kind of order. Here we encountered our next door neighbour, regarding us with some curiosity. She had heard the sounds of hilarity through the open French windows, and was now somewhat puzzled about the debris mounting up outside. We began trying to explain, but the effort only started us off again. We would get out a few words and then be engulfed by a fresh wave of mirth. Our neighbour could make little sense out of us, but gradually she too became infected by our laughter and joined in. Later that day I realised that although I felt very tired, my cold had vanished, not even a snuffle remained. So, next time you're suffering from a similar virus, dear listener, I can recommend having a good laugh, even if it's the last thing you feel like doing. Scientists will tell you that smiling and laughing produce things called endorphins in the bloodstream, which aid the general health of the body and give a sense of well-being. And these effects still take place even when the person smiling doesn't really feel like doing so. But don't let's worry about the mechanics. Let's just aim to enjoy ourselves and feel better in the process. Perhaps a favourite book will set you off. I'm a great fan of P.G. Wodehouse myself, and Terry Pratchett novels are popular reads. Or you might listen to one of our great comedians or comedy series. There's plenty of choice. Humour is a very personal thing. I think Victoria Wood is marvellous, and I'm sure you have your favourites too. What an important job these talented laughter makers do for our society. Some have gone into war zones to entertain the troops and keep up morale. A comedy radio show called ITMAR, short for It's That Man Again, ran throughout World War II and helped the people of Britain through some very grim times. The programme always seemed to be coming from the heart of London, even though it was produced in a well-hidden location in the depths of Wales. The Germans knew of the show and were amazed at its cheerful banter in the face of London's continual bombardment. Its contribution to the war effort must have been immeasurable. While we can laugh in a kindly way when contemplating life's incongruous happenings, we're not in danger of taking ourselves too seriously or being too affected by hurtful things and people outside. And in this way, we can benefit both physically and mentally. The great doctor Sigmund Freud recognised this, and he spent a lot of time trying to analyse the roots of humour, what it is that moves human beings to laugh. Comedian Ken Dodd waded his way through Freud's heavy technical writing on this subject, hoping to gain insight and help with his own comic material. Doddy gave up the struggle halfway, however, having come to the conclusion, Freud may have known a lot about humour, but Freud never had to play two houses at the Glasgow Empire Friday nights. Perhaps you may have a comic episode to share with Outlook listeners. Why not send it along to Postbag?
Doesn't a good laugh make you feel good? When we were babes and infants, many years ago in my case, nursery rhymes were part of growing up. But what's their origins and heritage, particularly as some of them aren't entirely PC now, of course? Elaine's been finding out from an article by Lucy Evans in This England magazine.
Nursery rhymes and hidden heritage completely shattered my happy childhood memories of nursery rhymes. Think back to when you were a child. Undoubtedly you listened to or sang nursery rhymes. They seemed nothing more than imaginative, often outlandish tales with a gentle rhyme passed down through the generations. However, scratch the surface and they reveal an altogether different story. Some nursery rhymes were little more than tales of morality, teaching children not to be lazy, to remember to say their prayers, or the consequences of their actions. However, many others carried sinister undertones, political or religious warnings. Tales of torture and execution carefully disguised within each rhyming couplet. Mary, Mary, quite contrary. One of the most well-known nursery rhymes, Mary, Mary, quite contrary, is one such poem. At first, it seems to be nothing more than a rhyme concerning a sweet girl watering her garden and watching it grow. However, underneath the silver bells and cockle shells is a far more chilling tale. Mary is supposedly in reference to Mary Tudor, the eldest daughter of King Henry VIII and a devoted Catholic. Commonly known as Bloody Mary, due to her persecution of Protestants during her reign, the garden mentioned in the nursery rhyme is an insinuation to the graveyards. As Protestants continued to practice their faith illegally, more were executed, often by being burnt at stake, and so the graveyards were growing in size. In many illustrations of the rhyme, Mary is seen as a little girl tending her flowers. In reality, the silver bells and cockle shells were not so pleasant. Silver bells was a colloquial term for the thumbscrews, while the cockle shells were understood to be a type of torture instrument. The pretty maids all in a row were in reference to a device that beheaded its victims, a mechanical machine known as the maiden, colloquially referred to as the maids, now known as the guillotine. The Grand Old Duke of York. The Grand Old Duke of York is another nursery rhyme with a historical story behind it. The rhyme is believed to date back as far as the 15th century and ridicules the defeat of Richard, the Grand Old Duke of York, during the historic Wars of the Roses. It is thought that the words of the rhyme refer to the Battle of Wakefield in December 1460, where Richard Plantagenet led his army to Sandal to defend his castle against the approaching Lancastrian army. Richard marched them up to the top of the hill. Sandal Castle was built on the site of an old Norman motte and bailey fortress and stood 33 feet above ground level. In a bout of foolishness, or even panic, Richard marched his army down again to the bottom of the hill to attack the Lancastrian army. His army was subsequently besieged and Richard was killed. Humpty Dumpty. Humpty Dumpty is one of the most well-loved and famous nursery rhymes. Contrary to popular belief, Humpty Dumpty, often depicted as an egg-like man sitting on a wall, was not based on a real person. It was said to be the name of a particularly large cannon used during the English Civil War at the Siege of Colchester. Colchester was protected by great walls which ran the entire circumference of the city and its castle. The cannon was strategically placed on a wall to fire at the enemy. An enemy blast smashed into the wall below Humpty, causing the cannon to fall into the muddy ground below. The cavaliers and their horses, all the king's horses and all the king's men, tried in vain to pull Humpty free from the mud and to resurrect him on an undamaged part of the wall. But they were unable to put Humpty together again. This had dire consequences for the cavaliers, as Colchester eventually fell to the rival parliamentarians. Oranges and Lemons. Oranges and Lemons is a rhyme fondly remembered from childhood. The original lyrics and exact date of origin are unknown. But Oranges and Lemons was a well-known square dance back in 1665. The rhyme mentions many of the churches in London, and the tune mirrors the ringing sound of the bells. As a child,
I remember playing a game while singing the rhyme, in which two children joined hands and formed an arch. The other children would go through the arch and then circle round to the back before going through again. During the last line of the rhyme, chop, 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 the last man's dead. The children forming the arch would bring their arms up and down in a chopping action as their friends passed through. It always became quite exciting at this point, as the child caught in the choppers on the very last word of the rhyme would be deemed out, not to mention having had their head chopped off. There are several meanings behind the rhyme. Some believe it has a sinister undertone associated with the executions that took place at Newgate Prison. Since Sepulchre Without Newgate is the largest church in the City of London, it was built around 1450 and was badly damaged during the Great Fire of London. It was rebuilt in 1670, and the historic tower holds the 12 bells of Old Bailey. The church's tenor bell rang out in the mornings of an execution at Newgate Prison, now the site of the Old Bailey Criminal Courts. The prisoners would wait on death row for the outcome of their fate. Executions took place on Monday mornings. At midnight on the Sunday night prior to this, the bellman of St Sepulchre would visit the victim by candlelight. Here comes the candle to light you to bed, to inform them of their fate. While ringing the execution bell, which was a large handbell, the bellman would recite, "And when St Sepulchre's bell in the morning tolls, the Lord above have mercy on your soul." At 9 o'clock on Monday morning, the executions would begin after the first toll of the tenor bell.
And Elaine will complete that heritage of nursery rhymes next week. It's now only about 3 weeks till the general election on July the 4th. And I guess the next item, entitled Flummery and Poppycock by Susie Dent, has something to do with that. But let's find out from Margaret.
The one thing we can be sure of in the next 4 weeks is a lot of bumph. Bumph through our letterboxes, bumph in our inboxes, and virtual bumph on our airwaves as campaigners take to the soapbox. At times it will feel entirely fitting that this word started life in military slang, where it was short for bum fodder, i.e. toilet paper. Throwaway promises and dispensable soundbites are coming our way in spades or on shovels, but thankfully the thesaurus is here with a shedload of terms for quatch, codswallop, and to borrow fittingly from Boris Johnson, the inverted pyramid of piffle. At the heart of nonsense, of course, is that it makes no sense, just as disease makes us feel ill at ease. The latter may be a regular response to the incoming bloviators, or blowers of hot air, and it won't be just the politicians. As election fever takes hold, our feeds will be bulging with ultra-crepidarians, those who love to hold forth on subjects they know absolutely nothing about. The result? More hokum, hooey, and utter humbug. It used to strike me as curious that meaningless piffle is couched so often in terms of food, until I learned that the earliest meaning of mess was an unappetizing mush of broth, porridge, or boiled vegetables. That link survives with improved menus, we hope, in the office's mess. Similarly, balderdash would have been known to Shakespeare as a frothy concoction of milk and beer, with the occasional bit of quicklime and pigeon's dung thrown in. Flummery, meaningless or insincere schmoozing that makes a nice alliterative pairing with fiddle-faddle and flim-flam, was a blancmange-style pudding whose name may come from the Welsh word Llymru, soft and slippery. We can take a near-literal poppet, Codswallop, said to be a nod to the soft drinks maker Hiram Codd, who successfully patented a glass bottle sealed with a ball in its neck. His drinks didn't fare quite so well and came to be viewed as the poor relation of real wallop, that is, beer. The story is certainly colourful, but the more plausible inspiration for one of our favourite nonsense words is the 19th century cod walloper, a dealer in fish. Fishiness and suspicion have never been far apart. Then we have hogwash, thankfully not designed for drinking, at least by humans. In the Middle Ages, it was used for kitchen swill for pigs. Best to leave any political pig connections there. Of course, nonsense has had its audience throughout the ages. Think of the mountebanks, literally bench mounters, who would stand on a platform at 16th century markets and proclaim the wonders of their medicinal wares. One of their more bizarre stunts involved asking their assistant to swallow a toad, believed to be highly poisonous, and then promptly curing them with their bogus potions. Today's toadying, follows of a spurious cause, prepared to swallow anything, have those early scammers to thank. Speaking of fraud, our 15th century ancestors seem prescient for coining trumpery to describe trickery and deceit. Among gardeners, it also described any weed that hindered the growth of valuable plants. 100 years later, temperiness had become the new catchword for anything flashy but worthless. It is almost as though we've always needed words for bosh, from the Turkish for empty, flapdoodle, it sounded good, and claptrap, designed to elicit applause. Linguistic jiggery-pokery may have begun with professional magicians, but it has successfully branched to those wishing to sprinkle fairy dust on a different stage. In the case of Buncombe, that stage was the US Congress, when in 1820, the member for Buncombe County in North Carolina stood up to deliver a rambling and inconsequential speech near the close of a debate, despite attempts by his colleagues to cut him off. The congressman carried on and on, declaring that he was obliged to make a speech for Buncombe. What he unwittingly made was an enduring byword for political baloney. Of course, it would be wrong to imagine that everything we hear before election day should be roundly dismissed as twaddle. The historical dictionary is curiously, and some would say unfairly, lacking in positive epithets for political pledges. It is telling that there is no current adjective to accompany the noun integrative lived and died in the 19th century. But it will be our job to sift through the baffle-gab and extract those promises we can trust. At the heart of the word election is the Latin picking out, after all. While we do, we will put up with any persistent poppycock, an expressive borrowing from Dutch, which means either soft, yes, that word, or dolls, yes, that word. Whichever version you prefer, you will at least have the bum fodder to deal with it.
Roll on July the 4th, I say, and end all the vague promises and mudslinging. Many of our listeners to Outlook rely on their faithful guide dogs to take them out and about, but like all dogs, they start life as mischievous puppies and have to be trained. And the first stage for a potential guide dog is puppy walking. Dave talks to Yvonne with her namesake trainee guide Labradoodle, David.
Hello there, I'm speaking to you from the garden of Boston Lodge, and we've got Yvonne here, and a lovely dog called David, and you're from the Guide Dogs.
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm a volunteer at Guide Dogs, so I'm a volunteer puppy raiser.
Yeah, so how old's David now?
David is 6.5 months old, and he's a yellow labradoodle.
A labradoodle, a cross between a labrador and a doodle. No, a poodle.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Yeah,
his mum was a yellow labrador, and his dad was a white standard poodle.
Okay. So why do they have that combination?
They have labradoodles for guide dog owners who are allergic to normal dog fur. Labradoodles, they don't shed that much. They have to be clipped. So once they've lost their puppy fur, they do very minimal shedding. So for any guide dog owners that are allergic to dog fur, it's ideal for them because all they'll do is they'll take them to the groomers and have them clipped. And so they don't get any allergic tendencies. And it works well for guide dogs because guide dogs are a very dog-centred and very people-centred charity.
Yes,
and so that means they're including all guide dog owners, including all their needs.
So what does David's training involve as far as you're concerned?
We got David when he was 8 weeks old, so the first things we have to do is we have to get them sleeping through the night and toilet trained, so they're not doing their toilet inside, they're doing it outside, and they're trained to a very specific command of busy, busy.
Yeah.
So when he needs to go to the toilet, I will say busy, busy, and he will do a wee. I will say big, busy, and he will do a poo. And that's important straight off, not only for the home situation, but also with the guide dogs. Because when the guide dog owner needs to take him into shops or cafes or restaurants, they know they can take him to a safe place and give those two cues, and David will do his spending. We also teach them all the normal things you would a normal dog: sit, lie down, stay, come, and recall to come to a whistle when he's on a free run. But we also do specific guide dog training as well. So David has to learn to find a chair to go under when he's lying on a bus or a train, and they also has to he has to learn to do a chin to rest it on a table or a chair, so when the vet is examining him, David will stand perfectly still and be examined.
Excellent.
So they're the specialist guide dogs training that he has to do. So
that's quite rare for dogs, so they hate vets, don't they?
David loves the vet. He loves going to the vet. The first few visits when we take them, it's just cuddle time for the pups before they have anything done. And then when he had his injection, he was having so much fun cuddling with the nurses and the vet he already knew. He didn't even feel the injection going in. Stop chewing the tulips.
That's nice, isn't it? There are some lovely tulips here, by the way, in the garden. Hey, now, you're also, David knows where Tesco's is.
It doesn't at the moment. It doesn't at the moment. David is still learning, so because he's only 6.5 months old, he hasn't gone into Leamington yet, so he hasn't been taught how to find places yet. So I'm still taking him to places, but he does have to learn how to walk around shops, supermarkets, without sniffing in the shelves and sniffing in other people's baskets and trolleys and taking things out. So he has to show good shop etiquette, that's what we teach them. So he walks calmly around the shops, ignoring other people, not sniffing at shelves, not sniffing at produce. And when I have to stop and find something in the shelves, he sits calmly and waits for me to move on until I say okay.
Yeah.
So that's all the shop etiquette that we're teaching them at the moment.
Yeah, the supermarkets tend to change things around. So how does I understand they've got a good nose for a loaf of bread.
Yes, guide dogs have got a good loaf of bread, but guide dogs also can distinguish something like 15,000 different smells. So they actually know the difference between the smell of a tin of beans and the smell of a tin of tomatoes.
Really? When they're inside a can?
Yep, even inside the can. They know the difference in the smell in the processing systems. So once they've been identified that smell goes to a tin of beans, if you hide a tin of beans in the supermarket, he will find it because he'll identify that smell to a tin of beans.
Absolutely. That's wonderful, that is. I could stick my nose against a tin and not have a clue what was in it.
Well, they've got nearly 10 times or even 100 times more effects that we have. So, yeah, he can smell things that we can't even detect. So, yeah.
Well, how do you feel when you have to hand over David?
David's my third dog now, and I've had to hand over two, and I always get really, really upset. I mean, we've had the puppy for a whole year,
so
it's hard because they come to us at 8 weeks old, a little tiny puppy. We've bonded with them, we've cuddled them, we've looked after them when they've been ill, and suddenly we're having to let them go. So it is always hard.
Yeah.
But when your dog qualifies and that guide dog owner comes up to you and says, "He's changed my life. I can now live my life." That makes it all worthwhile.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So how many puppies have you kind of brought up so far?
David's my third. Yeah. I've had Hugo, who was my first. Yeah. He was a German Shepherd Retriever cross. He is now qualified. And I've had Paxton, who was a black German Shepherd Retriever cross, and he's currently in Leamington doing his advanced training.
Wonderful. That gives you a sense of satisfaction.
It does.
Job
a sense done. Of pride, yes.
Wonderful. And thanks a lot for coming and talking about it to members of the Monday Club, because they were all fascinated. They really were. And they liked David as well. They liked to stroke David.
Yep.
Fantastic guest appearance from David, and also you, of course.
That's
Yvonne.
Absolutely fine.
Thank you very much for inviting us. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Another lovely dog being trained to give a visually impaired person a much fuller life.